It is a rather great favor to ask you, but we have already been greatly obliged with your kindness in offering us this opportunity to explain our problem. But if you would allow us to express our gratitude just slightly by... Devers scowled. He had heard this speech with its slight variations 20 times in the past month. It ended, as always, in a quick shift of the half-hidden bills. But the epilogue differed here. Usually the bills vanished immediately. Here they remained in plain view, while slowly the commissioner counted them, inspecting them front and back as he did so. There was a subtle change in his voice. "Backed by the Privy Secretary, eh? Good money." To get back to the subject, urged Barr. "No, but wait," interrupted the commissioner. "Let us go back by easy stages. I really do wish to know what your business can be. This money, it is fresh and new, and you must have a good deal, for it strikes me that you have seen other officials before me. Come now, what about it?" Barr said, "I don't see what you're driving at." "Why, see here. It might be proven that you are upon the planet illegally, since the identification and entry cards of your silent friend are certainly inadequate. He is not a subject of the Emperor." "I deny that." "It doesn't matter that you do," said the commissioner with sudden bluntness. "The official who signed his cards for the sum of 100 credits has confessed, under pressure, and we know more of you than you think. If you are hinting, sire, that the sum we have asked you to accept is inadequate in view of the risks..." The commissioner smiled. "On the contrary, it is more than adequate." He tossed the bills aside. "To return to what I was saying, it is the Emperor himself who has become interested in your case. Is it not true, sirs, that you have recently been guests of General Rios? Is it not true that you have escaped from the midst of his army with, to put it mildly, astonishing ease? Is it not true that you possess a small fortune in bills backed by Lord Broderick's estates? In short, is it not true that you are a pair of spies and assassins sent here to... Well, you shall tell us yourself who paid you and for what." "Do you know," said Barr with silky anger, "I deny the right of a petty commissioner to accuse us of crimes. We will leave." "You will not leave." The commissioner arose, and his eyes no longer seemed nearsighted. "You need answer no question now. That will be reserved for a later and more forceful time. Nor am I a commissioner. I am a lieutenant of the Imperial Police. You are under arrest." There was a glitteringly efficient blast gun in his fist as he smiled. "There are greater men than you under arrest this day. It is a hornet's nest we are cleaning up." Devers snarled and reached slowly for his own gun. The lieutenant of police smiled more broadly and squeezed the contacts. The blazing line of force struck Devers' chest in an accurate blaze of destruction that bounced harmlessly off his personal shield in sparkling spicules of light. Devers shot in turn, and the lieutenant's head fell from off an upper torso that had disappeared. It was still smiling as it lay in the jag of sunshine which entered through the new-made hole in the wall. It was through the back entrance that they left. Devers said huskily, "Quickly to the ship! They'll have the alarm out in no time!" He cursed in a ferocious whisper. "It's another plan that's backfired! I could swear the space fiend himself is against me!" It was in the open that they became aware of the jabbering crowds that surrounded the huge televisors. They had no time to wait. The disconnected roaring words that reached them, they disregarded. But Barr snatched a copy of the Imperial News before diving into the huge barn of the hangar, where the ship lifted hastily through a giant cavity burnt fiercely into the roof. "Can you get away from them?" asked Barr. 10 ships of the traffic police wildly followed the runaway craft that had burst out of the lawful, radio-beamed path of leaving, and then broken every speed law in creation. Further behind still, sleek vessels of the Secret Service were lifting in pursuit of a carefully described ship, manned by 2 thoroughly identified murderers. "Watch me," said Devers, and savagely shifted into hyperspace, 2,000 miles above the surface of Trantor. The shift, so near a planetary mass, meant unconsciousness for Barr and a fearful haze of pain for Devers, but light years further, space above them was clear. Devers' somber pride in his ship burst to the surface. He said, "There's not an Imperial ship that could follow me anywhere." And then bitterly, "But there's nowhere left to run for us, and we can't fight their weight. What's there to do? What can anyone do?" Barr moved feebly on his cot. The effect of the hypershift had not yet worn off, and each of his muscles ached. He said, "No one has to do anything. It's all over. Here." He passed the copy of the Imperial News that he still clutched, and the headlines were enough for the traitor. "Recalled and arrested. Rios and Broderick," Devers muttered. He stared blankly at Barr. "Why?" "The story doesn't say, but what does it matter? The war with the Foundation is over, and at this moment, Siwenna is revolting. Read the story and see." His voice was drifting off. "We'll stop in some of the provinces and find out the later details. If you don't mind, I'll go to sleep now." And he did. In grasshopper jumps of increasing magnitude, the trade ship was spanning the galaxy in its return to the Foundation. Chapter 10. The War Ends. Lathan Devers felt definitely uncomfortable and vaguely resentful. He had received his own decoration and withstood with mute stoicism the turgid oratory of the mayor, which accompanied the slip of crimson ribbon. That had ended his share of the ceremonies, but naturally, formality forced him to remain. And it was formality chiefly, the type that couldn't allow him to yawn noisily or to swing a foot comfortably onto a chair seat, that made him long to be in space, where he belonged. The Siwanese delegation, with Dukembar, a lionized member, signed the convention, and Siwenna became the first province to pass directly from the Empire's political rule to the Foundation's economic one. 5 Imperial ships of the line, captured when Siwenna rebelled behind the lines of the Emperor's border fleet, flashed overhead, huge and massive, detonating a roaring salute as they passed over the city. Nothing but drinking, etiquette, and small talk now. A voice called him. It was Farrell, the man who, Devers realized coldly, could buy 20 of him with a morning's profits, but a Farrell who now crooked a finger at him with genial condescension. He stepped out upon the balcony into the cool night wind and bowed properly, while scowling into his bristling beard. Barr was there too, smiling. He said, "Devers, you'll have to come to my rescue. I'm being accused of modesty, a horrible and thoroughly unnatural crime." "Devers?" Farrell removed the fat cigar from the side of his mouth when he spoke. "Lord Barr claims that your trip to Cleon's capital had nothing to do with the recall of Rios."
"Nothing at all, sir." Devers was curt. "We never saw the Emperor. The reports we picked up on our way back concerning the trial showed it up to be the purest frame-up. There was a mess of rigmarole about the general being tied up with subversive interests at the court."
"And he was innocent?"
"Rios?"
interposed Barr.
"Yes, by the galaxy, yes. Broderick was a traitor on general principles, but was never guilty of the specific accusations brought against him. It was a judicial farce, but a necessary one, a predictable one, an inevitable one."
"By psycho-historical necessity, I presume." Farrell rolled the phrase sonorously with the humorous ease of long familiarity.
"Exactly."
Barr grew serious. "It never penetrated earlier, but once it was over and I could, well, look at the answers in the back of the book, the problem became quite simple. We can see now that the social background of the Empire makes wars of conquest impossible for it. Under weak emperors, it is torn apart by generals competing for a worthless and surely death-bringing throne. Under strong emperors, the empire is frozen into a paralytic rigor in which disintegration apparently ceases for the moment, but only at the sacrifice of all possible growth." Farrell growled bluntly through the strong puffs.
"You're not clear, Lord Barr."
Barr smiled slowly.
I suppose so. It's the difficulty of not being trained in psychohistory. Words are a pretty fuzzy substitute for mathematical equations. But let's see now. Barr considered, while Farrell relaxed, back to railing, and Devers looked into the velvet sky and thought wonderingly of Trantor. Then Barr said, "You see, sir, you and Devers, and everyone, no doubt, had the idea that beating the Empire meant first prying apart the Emperor and his general. You and Devers and everyone else were right, right all the time, as far as the principle of internal disunion was concerned. You were wrong, however, in thinking that this internal split was something to be brought about by individual acts, by inspirations of the moment. You tried bribery and lies. You appealed to ambition and to fear. But you got nothing for all your pains. In fact, appearances were worse after each attempt. And through all this wild threshing up of tiny ripples, the Selden tidal wave continued onward, quietly, but quite irresistibly." Duquembar turned away and looked over the railing at the lights of a rejoicing city. He said, "There was a dead hand pushing all of us, the mighty general and the great emperor, my world and your world, the dead hand of Harry Selden. He knew that a man like Rios would have to fail, since it was his success that brought failure, and the greater the success, the surer the failure." Farrell said dryly, "I can't say you're getting clearer." "A moment," continued Barr earnestly. "Look at the situation. A weak general could never have endangered us, obviously. A strong general during the time of a weak emperor would never have endangered us either, for he would have turned his arms towards a much more fruitful target. Events have shown that 3/4 of the emperors of the last 2 centuries were rebel generals and rebel viceroys before they were emperors. So it is only the combination of strong emperor and strong general that can harm the foundation. For a strong emperor cannot be dethroned easily, and a strong general is forced to turn outwards, past the frontiers. But what keeps the emperor strong? What kept Cleon strong? It's obvious. He is strong because he permits no strong objects. A courtier who becomes too rich, or a general who becomes too popular, is dangerous. All the recent history of the empire proves that to any emperor intelligent enough to be strong. Rios won victories, so the emperor grew suspicious. All the atmosphere of the times forced him to be suspicious. Did Rios refuse a bribe? Very suspicious. Ulterior motives. Did his most trusted courtier suddenly favor Rios? Very suspicious. Ulterior motives. It wasn't the individual acts that were suspicious. Anything else would have done, which is why our individual plots were unnecessary and rather futile. It was the success of Rios that was suspicious. So he was recalled and accused, condemned, murdered. The Foundation wins again. Why, look, there is not a conceivable combination of events that does not result in the Foundation winning. It was inevitable. Whatever Rios did, whatever we did. The Foundation magnate nodded ponderously. So, but what if the Emperor and the General had been the same person, eh? What then? That's a case you didn't cover, so you haven't proved your point yet. Barr shrugged. I can't prove anything. I haven't the mathematics, but I appeal to your reason. With an empire in which every aristocrat, every strong man, every pirate can aspire to the throne, and as history shows, often successfully, what would happen to even a strong emperor who preoccupied himself with foreign wars at the extreme end of the galaxy? How long would he have to remain away from the capital before somebody raised the standards of civil war and forced him home? The social environment of the empire would make that time short. I once told Rios that not all the empire's strength could swerve the dead hand of Harry Selden. Good, good. Farrell was expansively pleased. Then you imply the empire can never threaten us again. It seems to me so, agreed Barr. Frankly, Cleon may not live out the year, and there's going to be a disputed succession almost as a matter of course, which might mean the last civil war for the Empire. Then, said Farrell, there are no more enemies. Barr was thoughtful. There's a second foundation. At the other end of the galaxy? Not for centuries.
Devers turned suddenly at this, and his face was dark as he faced Farrell. There are internal enemies, perhaps.
Are there? Asked Farrell coolly. Who, for instance?
People, for instance, who might like to spread the wealth a bit and keep it from concentrating too much out of the hands that work for it. See what I mean?
Slowly, Farrell's gaze lost its contempt and grew one with the anger of Devers' own.
Part 2. The Mule.
Chapter 11. Bride and Groom. The Mule. Less is known of the Mule than of any character of comparable significance to galactic history. His real name is unknown, his early life mere conjecture. Even the period of his greatest renown is known to us chiefly through the eyes of his antagonists, and principally through those of a young bride. Encyclopedia Galactica. Beta's first sight of Haven was entirely the contrary of spectacular. Her husband pointed it out, a dull star lost in the emptiness of the galaxy's edge. It was past the last sparse clusters, to where straggling points of light gleamed lonely, and even among these it was poor and inconspicuous. Toran was quite aware that as the earliest prelude to married life, the red dwarf lacked impressiveness, and his lips curled self-consciously. I know, Bay. It isn't exactly a proper change, is it? I mean, from the foundation to this. A horrible change, Toran. I should never have married you. And when his face looked momentarily hurt, before he caught himself, she said with her special cozy tone, All right, silly. Now let your lower lip droop and give me that special dying duck look. The one just before you're supposed to bury your head on my shoulder while I stroke your hair full of static electricity. You were fishing for some drivel, weren't you? You were expecting me to say, I'd be happy anywhere with you, Toran, or the interstellar depths themselves would be my home, my sweet, were you but with me. Now you admit it. She pointed a finger at him and snatched it away an instant before his teeth closed upon it. He said, If I surrender and admit you're right, will you prepare dinner? She nodded contentedly. He smiled and just looked at her. She wasn't beautiful on the grand scale to others. He admitted that, even if everybody did look twice. Her hair was dark and glossy, though straight, her mouth a bit wide. But her meticulous, close-textured eyebrows separated a white, unlined forehead from the warmest mahogany eyes ever filled with smiles. And behind, a very sturdily built and staunchly defended facade of practical, unromantic, hard-headedness towards life, there was just that little pool of softness that would never show if you poked for it, but could be reached if you knew just how, and never let on that you were looking for it. Toran adjusted the controls unnecessarily and decided to relax. He was one interstellar jump and then several milli-microparsecs on the straight before manipulation by hand was necessary. He leaned over backwards to look into the storeroom, where Beta was juggling appropriate containers. There was quite a bit of smugness about his attitude towards Beta, the satisfied awe that marks the triumph of someone who has been hovering at the edge of an inferiority complex for 3 years. After all, he was a provincial, and not merely a provincial, but the son of a renegade trader, and she was of the Foundation itself, and not merely that, but she could trace her ancestry back to Mallow. And with all that, a tiny quiver underneath. To take her back to Haven, with its rock world and cave cities, was bad enough. To have her face the traditional hostility of trader for Foundation, nomad for city dweller, was worse. Still, after supper, the last jump. Haven was an angry crimson blaze, and the second planet was a ruddy patch of light with atmosphere-blurred rim and a half-sphere of darkness. Beta leaned over the large view table with its spidering crisscross lines that centered Haven 2 neatly. She said gravely, I wish I had met your father first. If he takes a dislike to me... Then, said Toran matter-of-factly, You would be the first pretty girl to inspire that in him. Before he lost his arm and stopped roving around the galaxy, he... Well, if you ask him about it, he'll talk to you about it until your ears wear down to a nubbin. After a while, I got to thinking that he was embroidering, because he never told the same story twice the same way. Haven 2 was rushing up at them now. The landlocked sea wheeled ponderously below them, slate gray in the lowering dimness and lost to sight, here and there, among the wispy clouds. Mountains jutted raggedly along the coast. The sea became wrinkled with nearness, and as it veered off past the horizon just at the end, there was one vanishing glimpse of shore-hugging ice fields. Toran grunted under the fierce deceleration. Is your suit locked? Beta's plump face was round and ruddy in the encasing sponge foam of the internally heated, skin-clinging costume. The ship lowered crunchingly on the open field, just short of the lifting of the plateau. They climbed out awkwardly into the solid darkness of the outer galactic night, and Beta gasped as the sudden cold bit, and the thin wind swirled emptily. Toran seized her elbow and nudged her into an awkward run over the smooth, packed ground, towards the sparkling of artificial light in the distance. The advancing guards met them halfway, and after a whispered exchange of words, they were taken onward. The wind and the cold disappeared when the gate of rock opened and then closed behind them. The warm interior, white with wall light, was filled with an incongruous humming bustle. Men looked up from their desks, and Toran produced documents. They were waved onward after a short glance, and Toran whispered to his wife, "Dad must have fixed up the preliminaries. The usual lapse here is about 5 hours." They burst into the open, and Beta said suddenly, "Oh, my!" The cave city was in daylight, the white daylight of a young sun. Not that there was a sun, of course. What should have been the sky was lost in the unfocused glow of an overall brilliance, and the warm air was properly thick and fragrant with greenery. Beta said, "Why, Toran, it's beautiful!" Toran grinned with anxious delight. "Well now, Bay, it isn't like anything on the Foundation, of course, but it's the biggest city on Haven 2. 20,000 people, you know. And you'll get to like it. No amusement palaces, I'm afraid, but no secret police either." "Oh, Tori, it's just like a toy city. It's all white and pink, and so clean." "Well..." Toran looked at the city with her. The houses were 2 stories high for the most part, and of the smooth vein rock indigenous to the region. The spires of the Foundation were missing, and the colossal community houses of the old kingdoms. But the smallness was there, and the individuality, a relic of personal initiative in a galaxy of mass life. He snapped to sudden attention. "Bay, there's Dad, right there, where I'm pointing, silly, don't you see him?" She did. It was just the impression of a large man, waving frantically, fingers spread wide as though groping wildly in air. The deep thunder of a drawn-out shout reached them. Beta trailed her husband, rushing downwards over the close-cropped lawn. She caught sight of a smaller man, white-haired, almost lost to view behind the robust one arm, who still waved and still shouted. Toran cried over his shoulder, "It's my father's half-brother, the one who's been to the Foundation, you know." They met in the grass, laughing and incoherent, and Toran's father let out a final whoop for sheer joy. He hitched at his short jacket and adjusted the metal-chased belt that was his one concession to luxury. His eyes shifted from one of the youngsters to the other, and then he said, a little out of breath, "You picked a rotten day to return home, boy." "What? Oh, it is Selden's birthday, isn't it?" "It is. I had to rent a car to make the trip here, and Dragoon Randu to drive it." "Not a public vehicle to be had at gun's point." His eyes were on Beta now, and didn't leave. He spoke to her more softly. "I have the crystal of you right here, and it's good, but I can see the fellow who took it was an amateur." He had the small cube of transparency out of his jacket pocket, and in the light the laughing little face within sprang to vivid colored life as a miniature Beta. "That one," said Beta. "Now I wonder why Toran should send you that caricature. I'm surprised you let it come so near you, sir." Are you now? Call me Fran. I'll have none of this fancy mess. For that, I think you can take my arm, and we'll go to the car. Till now, I never did think my boy knew what he was ever up to. I think I'll change that opinion. I think I'll have to change that opinion. Taran said to his half-uncle softly, "How is the old man these days? Does he still hound the women?" Randu puckered up all over his face when he smiled.
"When he can, Taran, when he can. There are times when he remembers that his next birthday will be his 60th, and that disheartens him. But he shouts it down, this evil thought, and then he is himself. He is a traitor of the ancient type. But you, Taran, where did you find such a pretty wife?"
The young man chuckled and linked arms. "Do you want a 3 years' history at a gasp, Uncle?" It was in the small living room of the home that Beta struggled out of her traveling cloak and hood and shook her hair loose. She sat down, crossing her knees, and returned the appreciative stare of this large, ruddy man. She said, "I know what you're trying to estimate, and I'll help you. Age 24, height 5'4", weight 110, educational specialty history." She noticed that he always crooked his stand so as to hide the missing arm. But now Fran leaned close and said, "Since you mention it, weight 120. He laughed loudly at her flush. Then he said to the company in general, "You can always tell a woman's weight by her upper arm. With due experience, of course. Do you want a drink, Bay?" "Among other things," she said, and they left together, while Taran busied himself at the bookshelves to check for new editions. Fran returned alone and said, "She'll be down later." He lowered himself heavily into the large corner chair and placed his stiff-jointed left leg on the stool before it. The laughter had left his red face, and Taran turned to face him. Fran said, "Well, you're home, boy, and I'm glad you are. I like your woman. She's no whining ninny."
"I married her," said Taran simply.
"Well, that's another thing altogether, boy." His eyes darkened. "It's a foolish way to tie up the future. In my longer life and more experienced, I never did such a thing."
Randu interrupted from the corner where he stood quietly.
"Now, Fransart, what comparisons are you making? Till your crash landing 6 years ago, you were never in one spot long enough to establish residence requirements for marriage. And since then, who would have you?"
The one-armed man jerked erect in his seat and replied hotly,
"Many, you snowy dotard,"
Taran said with hasty tact. "It's largely a legal formality, Dad, that the situation has its conveniences."
Mostly for the women, grumbled Fran.
"And even if so," argued Randu, "it's up to the boy to decide. Marriage is an old custom among the Foundationers."
"The Foundationers are not fit models for an honest trader," smoldered Fran.
Taran broke in again. "My wife is a Foundationer." He looked from one to the other, and then said quietly, "She's coming." The conversation took a general turn after the evening meal, which Fran had spiced with three tales of reminiscence composed of equal parts of blood, women, prophets, and embroidery. The small televisor was on, and some classic drama was playing itself out in an unregarded whisper. Randu had hitched himself into a more comfortable position on the low couch and gazed past the slow smoke of his long pipe to where Beta had knelt down upon the softness of the white fur mat, brought back once long ago from a trade mission, and now spread out only upon the most ceremonious occasions.
"You have studied history, my girl?" he asked pleasantly.
Beta nodded. "I was the despair of my teachers, but I learned a bit eventually." "A citation for scholarship," put in Taran smugly. "That's all."
"And what did you learn?" proceeded Randu smoothly.
This book is continued on cassette number 4.